Hello and welcome to the First Take Film Club podcast. We have an absolute corker for you today as we delve into Danny Boyle's Oscar-winning delight, Slumdog Millionaire. But first, let me introduce myself, your host, Liam Jones, and my lovely Irish film nerd friend and co-host, Connor Norcott. Connor, how are you, pal?
I'm good, man. We've been recording for about 30 minutes and just been having a catch-up and a chat. And I said I looked at the agenda, I did, but then I didn't read the start where it says, my lovely film nerd friend. And I'm quite, that's quite a nice compliment. I'm good, man. I'm really good. How are you?
Yeah, mate. I'm good. I told you off air that I was going to tell you a funny story, and I might have picked up a little bit too much. But however, I will get onto it right now. So mum and dad came back from the shop, wherever they went. And mum said, oh, can you just... give me some scissors. Can you just cut this label out of my brand new dress? And yeah, sure. And it was a blunt pair of scissors. And I started to cut. And then I looked away. And then I looked back. And I've cut a hole in her dress, a brand new dress. She was absolutely fuming. But I couldn't stop laughing. Genuinely couldn't stop laughing. I thought it was hilarious.
What was your dad's reaction to that?
He was quite pissed off with the general like shouting. He was pissed off with not the fact that I did that. Yeah, he's trying to. He's on my laptop right now, mm-hmm. trying to buy a car, and he doesn't know how to work a laptop. He's there like an old man, mm-hmm. with his like big fat finger trying to like press down on the clicker like a caveman. Honestly, he doesn't have a clue. And mum's trying to help him do the laptop whilst also trying to fix a hole in her dress. It's quite funny, actually. So I've left a bit of a car crash in the other room, so mm-hmm. they can deal with that. They're cooking dinner as well, so, you know, Sunday roast. What more do you want? Luke is not here with us today. He's not dead. He's just had the vaccine and feels a little bit poorly. So we hope he gets better soon. I'm sure he will. It'll be a 24-hour thing, and then he'll be, you know, fighting off them COVID cells or whatever it is that the vaccine does. Right. Usually we like to open with an opening question. And this week, the question comes from my lovely film nerd friend, Connor. And the question is, what movie opinion have you completely changed your mind on? And I'll throw it to you first, Connor, as it was your question originally. So go ahead.
You know what? I remember... It might have even been the good days when we recorded in person and actually got to see each other. Remember that? That was so long ago. We kind of spoke a little bit, probably on the opening part of the podcast, because there wasn't a podcast dedicated to it, but about Knives Out. And I remember thinking it was 2 out of 5 stars. It was kind of average. It was a bit in love with itself. I thought it was really self-indulgent and it wasn't that funny. And since then, I must have watched it about 5 times. And each time I watch it, I'm like, this is really fucking good. And because you know all that, I'm not going to spoil anything, obviously, but because you know how everything all plays out on multiple watches, there's something really fun about watching it all happen. And I think it's kind of like, you know, like those old clocks, if you looked inside and you saw the cogs turning and everything working in harmony. And I don't know, I think I find that really engaging, and I enjoy it a lot because obviously you're looking at all the filmmaking aspects and how the narrative, you know, unrolls and whatever. But the other one is is Ocean's 12, which is, you know, regarded as probably the worst of the Soderbergh Ocean movies, and probably for good reason. There's especially a scene where Julia Roberts, who plays a character called Tess, impersonates the actress Julia Roberts in a museum, and it's not good. And then Bruce Willis comes in and Matt Damon, they're all making jokes about Hollywood and stuff, and it's really, really cringy. But when you are a little Irish film nerd like me and you like talking about Hollywood and all the intricacies of it, and you know, they talk about agents and all what that's like, and I just love it so much. And seeing all those actors like Pitt, Damon, Julia Roberts, George Clooney, etc., all just kind of have fun and hang out for 2 hours is so good. I love it so much, man. And that's one of the ones I've changed my mind on.
I'd love them to revisit that series. I know they did the Ocean's 8. I've not seen that one. But yeah, it'd be nice if they, like Clooney and Pitt, got back together and Damon. They all go back together.
You know what? Ocean's 8, which I don't really love, but Kate Blanchett's character in that, a little spin-off of her and Brad Pitt's character from Ocean's 11, 10, whatever, would be awesome. I'd be all over that. I'd like to see those two together. They're sick.
Isn't one of them related to George Clooney's character? Isn't that like the connection?
Yeah, yeah. I think it. Danny Ocean, who's George Clooney in Ocean's 8. I can't remember the name of the actress now. But, you know, she's his sister.
Sandra Bullock, is that who's
yes,
in it?
Yes, it's Sandra Bullock, yeah.
Sandra she's Bullock. Okay, so my answer to this question, it's a bit of a... So I've changed my opinion on this film franchise a couple of times. So the franchise is the Twilight Saga, right? When I was a kid, I absolutely loved it. I thought it was great. I thought it was amazing. I thought it was fun and entertaining. And I read the books as well when I was a kid. And it's a little, they're a little bit, you know, they're not very good, but they're, you know, they're fun. And as I got older, you know, as I probably about 16, I realized that, you know, well, I thought in my head, these aren't actually that great, are they? These aren't very good. They're a little bit rubbish. And then I got a little bit older again, and I was like, no, these are flat out. All of them are just awful. The worst films ever made, period. Like, the acting's terrible, the writing's terrible, the direction's terrible, everything's terrible. But last year, I decided to just sit down and rewatch them all, as they were all on Netflix. And I got to say, I had a blast. I genuinely had a blast watching. Yeah, yeah, for real. I had a proper blast watching all of them. I don't know if it was maybe like, you know, fueled by nostalgia, but I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. Another one, this one probably is going to be controversial. Okay. So when I was a kid, I loved Bond. I loved James Bond, right? I loved all of them. But I don't know. A few weeks ago, I watched Casino Royale, and I think it's a little bit boring.
I agree, actually. I did the exact same thing where I've watched all the Craig ones again.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of Casino and not a lot of Royale, if you know what I mean.
The structure of Bond films as well, they are unlike any other action film. It's so up and down, and then obviously you have the kind of global element where, you know, you're traveling from country to country, but in terms of like the actual narrative structure, it's always strange. It's never quite as linear as you expect, and it's never quite as like tangible either, which sometimes takes me out of it. With Casino Royale, I think that's what makes me feel like it's dragging, because it's not as conventional as like your generic action film. But, you know, it's just, I know Casino Royale is heralded as like the best Bond now these days. It is, you know, better than any of the Connerys or even Dalton or Roger Moore, or whoever is your favorite. But yeah, it's like boring.
I feel kind of similar. I love the last, like, you know what? There's about 45 minutes of an incredible movie there. The rest is actually pretty good. And the end, I don't really love either, where they go to Venice and stuff like. I know that's part of the plot, but it didn't really do it for me. Saying that, though, Mads Mikkelsen is the whole reason I watched that.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with him, man. He's the coolest guy. I love him.
Yeah. And the scene where Mads Mikkelsen is whipping Daniel Craig's balls is...
That's a really funny scene, actually.
It is funny, but then I also think, like, ow. That's painful.
Okay.
That's painful. Right, let's move on to the film. So Slumdog Millionaire is our first take today for Connor. It's my revisit. Came out in 2008, directed by the one and only Danny Boyle. I will just summarize the film a little bit for you if you don't know what the film's about. Very short summary. A Mumbai teenager reflects on his life after being accused of cheating on the Indian version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And it's kind of a flashback film where each question of the quiz show resembles an element of his life. And that's how the story progresses through him getting the answers correct. Really an interesting storytelling technique, to be honest, not one I've ever seen before. If you're interested, the budget was 15 million and the box office was 378 million, which is why. That's big. That's a big profit. Probably helped by the fact that it probably had, after following its 8 Oscar wins, it probably did have either a cinema re-release or, you know, with how the UK has the Oscar films, we tend to have them at the same time as the Oscars is kind of on, where America get it earlier. Yeah, that's quite impressive. Connor, I will go to you for your first take.
You know what? This has been one where I have put off for 13 years now. I've always wanted to watch it because I love Danny Boyle, and I don't know why I never got around to it. And I really regret it now that, well, I'm glad we did an episode on it, but I regret that it took me this long to watch it because I really loved it, man. And the first thing that really stuck out to me, and it kind of pervaded through the whole film, was just how fun and vibrant and energetic it is. And that should really come as no surprise if you watch Danny Boyle's films. He is kind of his films have this energy and this kind of pace to them that you can't not be engaged by them. But man, it kind of blew me away a bit. And it all kind of builds to these moments that come from, you know, the questions. And also, as well as that, it builds to this final big moment at the end, which we'll touch on later. But I was hooked the whole way. I loved it literally every second of it.
It is a brilliant film. So this is probably the only the second time I've ever seen it. I think I watched it years ago on Film 4, probably, because it's a Film 4 production anyway. So they would have got first dibs when it was released on, you know, probably a few months after DVD release. I remember a lot of this film, but it was years and years ago that I first watched it. So there are lots of elements that I didn't have a clue about, and I was, you know, pleasantly surprised. You know, I think it's refreshing, isn't it, when obviously one of us has one of us doesn't have a first take. We have like a revisit of a film that we've not seen in ages. I think it was the same with Saving Private Ryan. No, I can't remember what film it was, but it happens a lot, and it's fun to revisit films that you've not seen for years because, you know, you have a kind of opinion almost in your head of how you remember feeling or what you thought of the film at the time. And sometimes with this film, I remember thinking the film was amazing. And, you know, after second watch, the film is still amazing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way. But I think what I love about this film is the real kind of, it's kind of really pure, and it's real. It's real, and it feels like grounded, despite, you know, some might say that the premise is a little bit far-fetched in that the guy wins the jackpot and every single question just happens to be an element from his past. But I think that's the point of right at the beginning of the film, a question is asked, how did he do it? And you get four answers. You know, he cheated. He cheated. He's a genius. He got lucky, or it is written. And sometimes I think we will touch on this later, but just sometimes it is written, you know. Is it written in the stars? It's written in a book, you know. this is adapted from Vikas Swarup's book Q&A. I'm so sorry if I didn't pronounce his name correctly. I tried my best. And yeah, it's written from a book, the screenplay, it is written, the words the actor's speaking, it is written, and it is written in destiny or whatever you want to take from that.
They keep coming back to that, don't they? There's always these lines about destiny and fate, and normally, like, I think one of the things I was kind of wary that it was going to be really cheesy, because at first that you're exposed to so much heart and joy and you know, humanity in this film, and you're kind of like, oh, this is going really well. But yeah, if you've watched some of the later Danny Boyle films, which I don't love as much, they do kind of verge on the cheesy sometimes. And he kind of does play on that line of, or he kind of plays on the line in general as a filmmaker of, is that kind of a bit too far? Is that a bit too extreme? Or is that a bit too cheesy on the other hand? And I feel like this film is kind of in danger of that, but the heart and the humanity completely just wins throughout the film. It completely carries you throughout it, I guess.
I think what you have there as well is, I don't think it ever does go near that cheesy line, because of filming in India and having the Indian characters, and obviously there is then a direct kind of connection to like Bollywood films and what they represent. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, with that in mind, I think you kind of can easily distinguish the two, but also kind of see similarities as well, which is why when there is something that might be perceived as cheesy, I just think it's just mm-hmm. yeah, okay, Boyle can be like that sometimes, but I just think that is kind of it has to be that way for it to work, given the story. I just want to ask you about the actual premise then. So what did you make of the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire premise as a narrative point to kind of push the story along?
It took me a good 30 minutes to realize that was the film. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like in my notes, I even wrote, I think I wrote down like, oh, so the whole thing is the game show. Like each question is a part of, okay. I get that now. Because I was kind of wondering, like, I went in completely blind to this film. The only thing I knew was the big musical number at the end. And I knew about the end and then what happens there as well. And yeah, man, it took me a little while to clock on to that was how the film was going to be told. And that's how the narrative would kind of evolve or whatever. But I think once again, you could argue that maybe for some people it might be a bit gimmicky, but I just went along with it, man. Like I kept coming back to this thing of it was written or it's fate or it's destiny. And you kind of just have to, you know, sit back and let it happen and let it wash over you and, you know, take it for what it is on the face value. And then hopefully you can kind of extrapolate some other themes from that. But it worked for me, is what I'll say. It worked for me and I didn't find it boring. And I think because they don't just do the flashbacks, but because of the interrogation, it's not gimmicky. It's like, how do I put this? You're kind of learning about each character at different stages of their lives and how their story's told. So by the end, when it comes to the questions that kind of start to mean something, you're really rooting for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that works really well.
I think obviously this film kind of paints two pictures of India. One of the kind of really dark, ugly, kind of exploitative elements. And obviously there's also kind of religious civil wars going on. There's a scene where a group of people, normal people, not soldiers, come and batter a bunch of Indians with sticks who they call Muslims. They say, get the Muslims. Mm-hmm. So I think there are elements of this film that are really harsh and brutal. Obviously, we have this child torture in this film, which, you know, is it necessary? But I think you also get the beauty of India as well. And I think that is where I just wanted to touch on. She's credited as, I think, as assistant director and also casting director, Loveleen Tandon, who Boyle says himself was the cultural compass of this film. Like he couldn't have done it without her. Basically, he could not have done this film without her, and rightly so. Really, I think if you're doing a film that is solely in a different country to yourself, I think you need that advice. You need you need it to be real. Otherwise, it's fake. I think it kind of loses its credibility, which I think is really important. So I just want to come to you then, Connor, about your opinions on the kind of the brutality of what we see in this film with the child torture, etc.
It really kind of took me by shock. Like, once again, I'm going to keep coming back to this. I went in completely blind, not knowing anything about how 95% of the film plays out. So I don't know, man. I think it kind of took me a little while to get used to the tonal changes that happen in it. And it didn't ever feel too much. It didn't ever feel like I was going to get whiplash from it or anything, but it kind of, once again, it fleshes out the character, but it also makes you realize that, it fleshes out the character, but it also kind of adds to the stakes of him not just winning this money, but being able to get in touch with Latika at the end and all this stuff. And it kind of, once again, man, it worked for me and it never felt gratuitous. It kind of felt, like you said, with with her coming on as like the cultural compass. I really love that term because you do kind of get the sincerity behind it and the honesty, and you say it's real, and I couldn't, well, obviously I can't vouch for that, but from first watch, it feels completely authentic. Yeah. It feels genuine, and it feels kind of harrowing to watch that. So when it only makes the sweeter moments, the nice, the better they are. Mm. And also the sweeter moments also make the harrowing moments as horrible and hard to watch as they are. They all kind of works in symbiosis, I think is the term. Yeah, I really liked it.
Yeah, you kind of answered my next question, and I was going to ask, you know, are these scenes necessary? You know, there is a scene where you don't see it in graphic detail, but these men take out a child's eye, you know, simply for being a little bit annoying, but they are literally almost captured. They're being groomed, aren't they, to grow up, and the girls are being groomed to, like Latika, she's being groomed to be sold off as a bride when she grows up. The boys are being groomed to be part of the gang when they're older and, you know, commit crimes for them. And I think it's a really kind of pivotal moment when they escape. I think it was Salim who throws the acid or whatever it is on one of the goons' faces, and they just kind of, they get off and they get on the train and they escape. And that is brilliant. And it's kind of at that point where you do start to see a lighter tone for probably about 20, 30 minutes when they're during the flashbacks. And you get this, it's the innocence of childhood, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's the innocence. Totally. And it's funny at times as well. Like, I think there's a moment where these German tourists come up to, I don't know if it was Salim or Jamal. Mm-hmm. And they say, they thought he was a tour guide. And he just goes along with it, and it's funny. Mm-hmm. It's funny, like, and then he's like, I think he gets a bit of a smack at the I don't know who it was, by like a guard or something. And then there's the American tourists who are like giving him a hug, like leave him alone, like and give him some money. And he's like, this is a bad man. I think it's just,
I love that moment, that American moment where I don't know what the line is previous or whatever, but essentially the kid says something about, oh, you wanted to know what India's like, and he gets battered, and then the wife of this American couple goes, well, this is how America helps. And then she rides money at her husband, like, give him money. And I was like,
yeah,
that's fucking great. That's so funny. And there's maybe one or two jokes in this that I think are really, really hilarious, but I fully LOL'd, laughed out loud at that.
Yeah.
I really, really liked that.
There are a couple of moments. One that made me chuckle was when Jamal is old and I being played by Dev Patel. He's brilliant in this. And I think it's like he's in an English class or something like that, because I think they're at a telecoms job where they're learning English. Yeah. And the teacher's showing them a Radio Times, and it's Cat off of EastEnders. And then they go to Jamal, and Jamal just literally blurts out the recent plots of EastEnders. I just thought it was brilliant. You bring in this, you know, this popular British soap into this, you know, this Oscar-winning, like, great film. It's just funny. It is really fun. And then at the start of the film as well, where little young Jamal jumps into pure runny shit just so he can get his hero signature, which is like, it's gross, but it's also hilarious. He's pushing through the crowd, wiping shit on everyone. And fair play to his idol. He signed his photo for him.
I do really love that. I love that. And in fact, there's two things I want to talk about with that scene. Firstly, it's like a callback. I mean, obviously it's a callback to Trainspotting, in my head anyway, with the worst toilet in Scotland and him having to try and get the suppositories or whatever. I just love that. And as a little throwback.
You expect it to be that deep.
I know, fully. He comes up and he's submerged in shit.
Yeah. I thought he was going to just be like, you know, up to his knees, but I was like, oh my God, he's actually gone all the way in.
I love that part. And I also love that after that, you see his best friend, Salim, sell the autograph. And in that, like, only looking back on it now, but in that, that kind of sums up their relationship and kind of foreshadows what's going to happen between them and the betrayal. And the betrayal, but still the bond being there of friendship. And I only now I'm thinking like, oh, that's really good filmmaking. Yeah. Really, really good filmmaking.
Yeah, their friendship and their bond is quite powerful actually, because despite everything, even at the end is during Jamal's final question on the show, he refers to Salim as his brother.
Mm-hmm.
Even then, right at the end, despite everything, despite that, there's a moment which is kind of, I wrote it down as is, it's like the pivotal moment in the relationship between Latika, Jamal, and Salim, when following Salim just murdering the mob boss, he points a gun in Jamal's face and tells him to leave him alone with Jamal's, like, the love of Jamal's life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just kind of spent the night kind of just lying down next to her, just kind of chatting. And then Salim comes in with a fucking revolver and he points at his head and he's like, you know, just leave. And then she, you know, cooperates and she's like, yeah, Jamal, just leave.
Mm-hmm.
And like that kind of, you see and feel that heartbreak as well, which I think we'll get onto characters a bit more in a bit. But I think this film is fundamentally a story of love, really. You know, it's Jamal's love for Latika. It's Jamal's love and kind of his kind of desperate longing to kind of right the wrongs, maybe not his wrongs, but just the wrongs in his life, you know, with Salim. I think is really, really powerful. And just going back to kind of the lighter moments, I just really wanted to make a point of this. The moment when they're on the train and they start selling all these goods and MIA Paper Plane starts playing, it gives me goosebumps.
Yeah,
like,
man.
That moment in the film gives me goosebumps because the song is a fun song as well. It's like really, it's a really popular song. And I think MIA, I think she has quite a few little bits and bobs, strips and drabs of her music coming in to the film as well, which we'll get on later. But that scene is just perfect. And it plays on that, the kind of innocence of childhood and how like being a kid is fun. And we see that, like, despite what they're doing, which is, you know, they're hustling at like 8 years old, you know, which is, it's, no one should be doing, but they don't know any different. And they're kind of just enjoying themselves and enjoying their lives despite everything that's going on. And I really like that about this film. Do you have anything else to add about kind of the plot as it were?
I do, but I kind of want to touch on it in terms of like the techniques and stuff, because there's so much of that once again all works in harmony and makes it such a film. Normally you find with Oscar films that like, oh yeah, they come out, they win an Oscar, yeah, they definitely deserve that, and then you watch them 2 years later and they're a bit shit. I'm looking at you, The Revenant, which is a bit crap, to be honest. And this holds up, man. Like, obviously, yeah. I never seen it in 2008, but to me, like, you look at these big Oscar tentpole films and you think, oh, okay, it's a film made for the Oscars, and this is just a film that I could watch this tomorrow or today if I wanted. Like, I could put it on anytime, it would be awesome. So, and it's all because of everything all working in harmony. So I think in terms of narrative and stuff, I'll try and touch on it a little bit more in terms of techniques and characters and stuff like that.
So before we kind of go back to the characters and the performances, I just want to touch on some of the technical elements of this film that you have just spoken about, Connor. And one of the main things that stuck out to me is the lighting, whereby the cinematographer, Anthony Dodd Mantle, who won an Oscar for this actually, uses these like dark, murky kind of greens, these real like kind of ugly colors during the ugly scenes, as it were, to kind of, and it does really, really add to the kind of the horrifying kind of things that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
But what I love even more, obviously that's great, and it does add to these darker moments, but when there's one moment in particular when Latika, as her older self, played by Freda Pinto, she comes to meet Jamal at the train station, and there is this shot of her, and it's like a kind of, it's almost zooming in, I don't know that technique that they keep using throughout the film, where it goes almost like slow-mo slightly blurry around the kind of outside of the shot. I don't, you know what I'm referring to, right?
I do, but I don't know the name of that one either. I know what you mean though.
Yeah, but they use it a lot, and it's kind of I don't know what the hell it is, but it works anyway. Yeah. And when you see Jamal look at Latika, and it's kind of bright, and you know her face and her smile, it's like that's perfect. And then obviously what happens afterwards isn't so perfect.
It's the shot that's kind of from Jamal's point of view, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's like I think it's just a pull focus where they change the focus, like the focal length. So the only thing that's in frame is her. So if you're looking from his point of view, the only thing that matters to him at this point is her. And then once you talk about that, like it's snatched away from him in almost 10 seconds after that. But you know, I know.
Yeah.
I love the cinematography, and I didn't realize that it won best cinematography, and it fully, I don't know what else came out in 2008, but this film is stunning. Like it really is. And I wish I looked this up, but what it was shot on, it looks really digital, but I know it's 2008, but at the same time, like there is kind of like a texture to it. Mm. And I think that's also to do with, you know, how the footage is actually edited and put together, because there's this thing in Danny Boyle's films where he just loves a technique called the Dutch angle or a canted angle, where the camera's like shifted on its axis, so it's looking at you almost diagonally. And normally that's kind of to show something being out of place or something being like out of whack or whatever. And I guess you could kind of incorporate that in some of the themes in the film, but in this they use it so often, and it's almost like the world that Jamal and his friends live in, it has been kind of skewed by their experiences or their history or their past or whatever. So then when it comes to these questions and you're finding out more about it, it's almost like you're understanding why he is the way he is. And he's like, obviously I'm not the cinematographer of that film. I don't know if that's what was intended with him and Danny Boyle or whatever, but if that's what it was, and it works, it's a really nice interpretation of it, I think. And it kind of adds to the fundamentals of the film.
Yeah. There are kind of three things that come together here and they work perfectly. It's Danny Boyle's direction. It's Loveline Tandon as the kind of the cultural director. She was heavily involved in casting most of the kind of the background actors and the young actors that play Latika, Jamal and Salim, which is, you know, I think their performances as kids as well are spot on. They are so, so great. She was heavily involved as well in, I read that Danny Boyle kind of didn't know whether to go for, you know, English throughout, but she was adamant that, you know, when they're kids, they need to speak their kind of their native language. It needs to feel grounded and real. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of, and Danny Boyle's like since said, yeah, you know, she was spot on there because it works so much better. But yeah, then those two as well, working with the cinematographer, they've managed to, with the kind of the busyness of the with the streets and with the markets and kind of this the buzz of like Indian life in these, is it most of it in Mumbai? Isn't it? I think it's brilliant. I think like to capture that, and it obviously isn't shot, I don't think, right in the middle of, you know, the city of Mumbai. I don't think that would have been practical. So to actually manage to create this, I think it's great, because it does have that really natural feel to it, this raw feel. I think in those moments as well, you feel like you're there, you know, in these kind of busy market streets, which I think it's so, so good.
I love that. It's the cinematography, the casting, the score, the soundtrack, and especially the editing all coming together, because it's so fast, it's so quickly edited, and it's not hard on the eyes, it's not hard to watch, it's not draining. Like I'm thinking of other films that are edited really quickly. I'm looking at Michael Bay movies, for instance. They drive me insane because the edits don't mean anything. They're just cutting because there's either been mistakes in the film where they're cutting to kind of fake rhythm and fake the kind of the impact that that part of moments in their film should have. Whereas in this, it actually serves the narrative. It serves the kind of, like, when you think you're a kid, all you're doing is running around trying to live your life and be as energetic and as expressive as you are. That you see that in these kids, and you see that in the editing. And then when it comes to the slower moments, I'm thinking about the game show as well. That kind of matches that too, where it's just kind of locked off shots, you know, kind of shot reverse shot edits, where the action really only is to do with him and the guy, the game show host, who's asking him the questions. So once again, it's establishing the kind of who Jamal was as a child and kind of who he is now, and some of the importances that he still kind of carried with him. And I just love that, man. Like, it seems like something that should be, it should be a norm in films, where the editing and the cinematography and everything should kind of amplify and augment the narrative. But you'd be surprised that I don't think it works in a lot of films as well as it does in Slumdog Millionaire. Especially, you touched on earlier, sorry, just quickly, the train scene where they're running across the train and there's kind of hustling their way across India and stuff. You know, they stop off at the Taj Mahal, all that kind of, that montage with the paper planes, the MIA song playing, is so good. And normally montages are just kind of filler almost to show what a character's done to be who they are now. But it all, once again, it's just done so well. It's executed so perfectly and tonally. It flawlessly works that,
yeah,
that it kind of, once again, it kind of bolsters the whole film as a result.
I think it is my favorite technical aspect of this film is the score and the soundtrack by A.R. Rahman, who won an Oscar for it as well. And he also won an Oscar for original song, which is J-Ho, which we hear at the end, which absolutely, I was thinking, where have I heard this song? Yeah, the Pussycat Dolls.
Pussycat Dolls, man. Afterwards. Yeah. I've been literally singing it in my head all day today. And it's been kind of driving me mad. I don't know if it's a good way or not, but it's been stuck in there since hearing it last night.
Yeah, yeah. I read a little bit that A.R. Rahman said about writing this song, and you know, he was obviously adamant to keep it in Hindi, and but he said he needed to use a phrase that was catchy and that we'd all languages mm-hmm. would understand and they would latch onto, and that's where he came with J-Ho. It's great. It's great. It is super fun.
You literally hear that song and I think of the year that song came out, and it was mad. Yeah. It was everywhere. It was literally everywhere. Yeah.
But like the score, man, there is one particular moment which is might be like one of my most favorite pieces of music in a film that I've heard in ages, and it's I think it is the train moment when they escape the gang as kids. And it's this like almost like electronic mixed with like Indian music, classic Indian music. And it's so kind of vibrant, but also like moody. So you kind of like feel, you know, stressed because that is how they're feeling in that moment. And it's mad. The different styles. You've got like classic Indian mixed with like reggae and Brazilian drumming, and then your Western electronic music, and it all comes together in this brilliant melting pot of just awesomeness. Mm-hmm. Like, no wonder he won the Oscar for this, because it's experimental too, right? And Danny Boyle, he has a track record for, you know, good music in his films.
Yeah.
You know,
bangers, only bangers allowed. Yeah.
He has a track record, and you know, using you know MIA's music, you know, which is like she's brilliant, she's great. Mm-hmm. I can't think of, you know, any other specific artists who are used in this film, but it's vibrant, and I think it adds to the feel as well, because you can one second, you know, like I said, be like that kind of real kind of like moody vibe, but also like the music is still kind of like energetic and almost fun, and then at the same time, you know, you have different music where it's like they use paper planes, which is almost like a happy song in a way. Maybe not the actual lyrics aren't maybe that happy, but the feel of the song is. I don't know, maybe if that's because it was used on Pineapple Express trailer and everyone just kind of like,
oh wow, is that where you think of that from?
Well, that's where it got its. So it first got fame through that film.
Yeah.
Through the trailer for that film, and everyone assumed that that song was used in the film itself, but it wasn't. So yeah, that's where it gained popularity. Wow. And then
I remember hearing it in like a video game once, like a little montage that started, and I was like, "What is this? This is the best song ever!" And since then, yeah, I've been all over it.
Honestly, last night when I was playing FIFA, I just stuck on MIA and listened through. I think I listened through her first three albums.
She's got some tunes, man.
Honestly, she is brilliant. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've got anything to add on the score and the soundtrack.
No, I don't know if I could do anything else justice. You kind of, there's kind of one little thing, maybe. It's a bit tangential, but anyway, you mentioned the kind of Brazilian influenced drumming. Have you ever seen a film called City of God?
Kind of, not properly. Okay. Kind of.
Well, there's so many moments in this film that kind of remind me of it. And obviously it's about like, it's instead of it being slums in India, it's about the favelas in Brazil.
Yeah.
And how these kids are kind of recruited into organized crime and the story of this one kid in particular. There are moments that kind of remind me quite a lot of it, especially the start. I love the opening moments of this film where the kids are being chased straight away, and I love that. And they're being chased from a cricket game, and Jamal goes to catch the ball, and the plane flies over, and he misses it. All that stuff, I just love it so much. And I wrote down in my notes, like, this feels really kind of indicative of City of God, and I think it came out 5-6 years or something after City of God. So I wonder if there was some influence there. But it's interesting that you picked up on the Brazilian drums, because that might have just been like a subtle little, like, nod of the cap or whatever.
Right, so let's move away from that now, and let's go back to the characters and the performances. I think Dev Patel, obviously, he made his name, or not made his name, but he started out in Skins.
I remember him from Skins too.
Yeah. I think everyone started out in Skins. You know, you've got Dev Patel, Nicholas Holt, Daniel Kaluuya, and he was only a bit part in that. Look at him now; he's absolutely huge. He started out in that, and then I think maybe off the back of that, because I think maybe this came out a couple of years after he finished his role in Skins. This really did kind of throw him out there, and now he is a big movie star. He is kind of an A-lister now, but he's so he's naturally great, right?
Mm-hmm. He's got so much charisma in this film. Like, he can literally do anything in this film and does everything he does. I think my favorite part of him is there's some scenes where he looks a little bit lost and a little bit taken aback by everything that's going around him, especially in the game show when the host is kind of being a bit of an asshole to him. But I love the moments where he's in the interrogation bit and they're asking him questions and he's just hitting them with these one-liners. And they're all fucking hilarious. And he's so witty and quick, and he carries it off in such a normal kind of everyday guy vibe. He's not big headed. He's not self-absorbed. He's just a really cool dude and a kind of rounded individual. And I think Dev Patel's perfect casting for that.
Yeah. When he's about to answer the question for 10 million rupees, I think he asks the host, "Are you nervous?" Mm-hmm. And he was like, "Am I nervous?"
Yeah.
You cheeky little you can tell right there is some obviously there's not much character development of the host. I think his name is Prem. Mm-hmm. He's played by Anil Kapoor. Mm-hmm. And he kind of you do get this little insight in that he says, you know, I'm the only other person that's ever done this before, and then he gives him the wrong answer. He says that he gave him the wrong answer because he wanted to prove whether or not he was cheating. I think he gave him the wrong answer because he didn't want Jamal to be the star. He wanted to be the only person to have won the jackpot.
I thought he actually got it wrong, and that's why he was annoyed. But yours makes way more sense. Yours makes so much more sense. Obviously, that's it. Obviously, yeah.
Yeah, I because he does... after that, when he gives him the wrong answer and Jamal says D, and he looks visibly annoyed.
Yeah,
you know, and he's like, "Are you exactly sure? Are you sure you don't mean B? Are you sure?" And I think that is just an interesting, you know, you get, you know, maybe like a little 30-second bit where you do get this, you know, little bit of insight into how this quiz host is thinking and feeling. And, you know, they make the point that, oh, it's to try and see whether or not he's cheating. I mean, mm-hmm. he's clearly not cheating. How would you cheat? He doesn't have a wire on or anything. You know, they found that out immediately. So I just think they were probably more angry that he won the jackpot. Also, yeah. The jackpot is only equivalent to £200,000. Did you know that?
Yeah, but it doesn't, I guess, who wants to win 200 grand doesn't sound as good. You know what I mean? I don't know obviously there's a name in Hindi for it, but...
But I did some Googling because I wanted to know whether or not this would still be, you know, if you won 20 million rupees, would you be as rich as a millionaire in like the UK? The answer is yes, because India, I looked at the GPA per capita and they are like 147 down the list. So if you have 20 million rupees, you are one of the richest people about. You could probably buy a lot, like way more than you could buy with 200 grand here. You know, 200 grand here wouldn't even buy you a house. No. 200 grand in India in rupees would buy you a fuckload, which I thought was quite interesting. I was intrigued by that. Let's go back to kind of the kind of core relationships, which is Jamal, Salim and Latika. And we get to see their lives in three different stages. I think it's interesting that, you know, Salim in the end winds up dead in a bath full of cash. You know, it's probably, he feels like, I think he finally feels at the end that he has messed up and he's chosen the wrong path. Whereas Jamal, in a sense, took the right path, you know, and like, you know, going back to that question from the start, I guess it is written, you know, that Jamal would be the good guy in the end and he would rescue Latika, you know, who is now, you know, in her before she gets rescued as such, she is almost captured as like a wife or a girlfriend of this new mob boss who is kind of has Salim in his grasp too. And I think it does kind of paint a real ugly side of kind of like the gangsters of India as well. I think that's quite interesting. There's gangsters everywhere, man. You know, I always forget that there's gangsters everywhere.
That whole thing kind of threw me off, by the way. Like, obviously, it was a first take for me. I didn't know much going in, but the whole idea that they touch on like the underworld and like the crime of, and seeing how Salim's character kind of, I want to say recruited, but that feels too genuine. He's kind of forced into this life. That really affected me, you know. And I feel like I kept thinking about this, the Three Musketeers, that kind of parallel that they touch on quite often. And I've never read that. I've not watched any of the films of it or whatever. But I'm sure at the end that they are disbanded. They're no longer together. It's no longer All for One and One for All or whatever. And I think when you see his death, that's kind of like a nod to the fact that it was never going to be the three of them. And that even comes back itself to when he lets go of Latika, when they're trying to escape from the camp and he lets go and she doesn't get on the train with him and Jamal. And even that moment, that really pissed me off. And it's so hard because it means that the next bit, which is the train stuff that we all loved of him kind of hustling the tourists or trying to sell stuff or do whatever they can to make a quick buck, it was still enjoyable, but it made it kind of like that little fucking bastard dropped.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I was so pissed off at him. Yeah, man.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, that it's always, even from like the youngest of ages that they're depicted, it's always Salim that has been the kind of the leader of their little their little trio and the grafter, really, and that he's more streetwise. You know, you see him giving a little crying baby to Latika because people will feel sorry for them if they have a crying baby and maybe give them more money. There's another point. Yeah, obviously he sells Jamal's autographed photo. There's other things he does. Obviously he kills the mob boss.
My man.
And then he points the gun in Jamal's face and tells him to leave them alone. And, you know, there are all these points. And he even makes a point of saying to Jamal at one point, you know, I'm the boss. I can't think of the term he uses.
I remember that. He has this great line, and it's something like, the man with the Colt 45 said, get out. And I was like, that's the most badass thing I've ever heard of my life. That sounds like a 50 Cent lyric. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't sound like it should be in Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah. Which, what did we then make of the final question asked in the quiz, which is for, you know, the jackpot? I personally loved the fact that it's about the Three Musketeers, and it kind of then loops everything back. It connects everything. It's like it makes everything then, which it's at one point feels quite, you know, dispersed, it then makes everything feel like really tight knitted.
Yeah.
And it's like it's that might have been like the perfect way to kind of finish that quiz with a question about the Musketeers. And then you have this little flashback where it goes to Jamal going, oh, she can be the third Musketeer, like pointing to Latika. And it's like in that moment, again, you kind of, you're seeing that Salim is going to get shot and killed. You at the same time as Latika is trying to get a phone call because
she's the phone of friend. It's all great. It's all so good, man.
But But the amazing thing about it is Salim was actually Jamal's phone of friend, but Salim gave Latika his mobile. So then it ended up being Latika who was the phone of friend. And she didn't know the answer either, but he's just so happy that she answered and she's there and she's safe. That's what she says on the phone is, she said, are you okay? And he said, I'm safe. And that was like, that is more than the jackpot to him. That's all he wanted. And it is very, very, very well written, very well adapted. No wonder that won an Oscar as well, adapted screenplay.
What a
surprise.
You asked me about it and it reminded me, and this might sound a bit mad, it reminded me of the end of The Godfather, right? Where they have these three different strands of what's happening at the minute. There's Michael becoming the godfather to his sister's kid. There's Michael becoming the godfather of the family and, you know, imposing himself and kind of, you know, taking on all the other bosses, getting his men to do all the other work and take on his other bosses. And then there's Michael kind of getting rid of the rats in his own crew when he finds out that Tessio betrayed him. And it all happens at one, like it's all intercut together. So all the three strands come together at the end. And I think the priest asks him something like, do you reject all evil? And it cuts to, you know, one of the other mob guys getting killed or something. But all the three strands come together and everything that was dispersed, like you said, is all tied up. That's classic filmmaking and a classic moment in a you know, much heralded and loved film. And this does the exact same thing. And it does it so well that it never feels, it doesn't feel like a gimmick. It just is the perfect kind of, it's the perfect closer, perfect last joke in a comedy set. Or this kind of reminds me of Whiplash as well, where, you know, you have that big moment, the final drum solo, and it ends just as J.K. Simmons throws his hands up. It's like the last kind of mic drop moment. And it's so good, man. And obviously it goes on a little bit in Slumdog where he meets up with Lasker or whatever, and they do the big musical number, the kind of Bollywood homage, which I kind of love that too. But, you know, I think comparing it to those films that have the big perfect end and the big thing that kind of wraps everything together, it's a classic. It kind of has made the film a classic for me, and I don't know if it gets as much credit as it deserves, which is something maybe we can squeeze in for the next couple of minutes, but I just wonder if, I don't know if people talk about it the way it should be talked about. And obviously it's only my first time watching it, but, you know, I don't know what you think.
No, it definitely doesn't get the credit. The fact that, you know, we didn't realize that it won 8 Oscars, which is, you know, a shit ton of Oscars for one film to be taken away. I think it probably has there's a few things to do with it. I think you've got a British director. the Oscars and the American Awards, they just, they love Hollywood. They love it. Yeah. And what is interesting about this film is it's only the second ever film to win Best Picture that didn't have an American production team involved in the production of the film. Wow. And that, in a sense, for me, says it all. You know, that is why we probably don't hear as much about it. You know, when each year at the Oscars, they'll chat about, you know, other films that have been great and successful in the past, and Slumdog's never mentioned. And, you know, for me, that is why. It's a British and Indian production companies involved in the film, you know, and it's a largely Indian cast, mm-hmm. you know, with a British and an Indian director. And, you know, Hollywood in 2008, yeah, they might be getting a little bit better now, fine. But in 2008, you know, that's probably why. Yeah, they got the awards. That's amazing. But, you know, you want to have the legacy too, right? You want to have the legacy. Sometimes mm-hmm. the legacy is more important than the awards.
I agree.
I don't know if, I don't know what you can do to kind of build that legacy for this film that deserves it, 100% mm-hmm. deserves it. I don't know, man. Maybe I'll just watch it every month so that
we'll tweet about it every week. Yeah. That's what we'll do.
Yeah, because it fully deserves it. And I just, one final plot point that we'll just talk about, and it is that, again, you know, the kind of the wrapping up of the film from the beginning and the end, the opening question, you know, how did he do it? The final shot, and it you know, it comes up just, you know, tiny small writing, just as he's like kissing Latika, and it says, "It is written." And then that is in itself, you know, a question of, you know, legacy, and, you know, is it written in the stars, I suppose? And I think Jamal certainly thinks it is. He certainly thinks it is.
He's a headstrong guy, isn't he? He fully goes for it.
That's why I certainly think that he doesn't really bat an eyelid when he gives the answer to the question, because I think he has full confidence that it is kind of destiny that's gotten him this far, and it will be destiny that gets him this answer correct, you know. And of course it's destiny. Every single question is linked to his life.
I know.
Of course it's destiny. And I think that is in itself beautiful. I think, you know, some people might, you know, maybe scoff at the fact that it's our destiny. Bollocks is a bit of a cop-out maybe, but I think you still have to, you know, no matter how grounded a film is, I think this film is still pretty grounded, you still have to suspend disbelief at times.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think, like, the magic of the film comes from this, you know, comes from this whole element that, you know, things can be, you know, destined, you know, like this. And fuck me, Jamal deserves it.
Exactly. You know, not everything has to be this big social realist bleak film, even though that's the kind of stuff I like. We don't need that all the time. And it has all these callbacks to other films. There's clear influence there from, like, going all the way back to, like, the 50s and French New Wave. It kind of reminds me of The 400 Blows by Truffaut and stuff. There's so many films that are kind of tangential to this and so close to it, but this is its own entity. And you know what's mad, just to quickly end on, when we had Tom and Jack from Kate and Jack on a couple of months ago, in fact probably a bit longer than that, I remember one of us asked him what was the film that made him want to be a filmmaker, and I think he mentioned Slumdog, and he mentioned meeting Danny Boyle. And now after watching it, I get it, man. It's literally that good. It really is that good. And it deserves all the Oscars and all the credit, and hopefully a bunch of popcorns as well, hopefully.
Yeah. I think it was funny last night when we were talking in the chat, and you said something about Trainspotting being his Danny Boyle's legacy. Was that the word you used?
I think something like that. Yeah.
Something like that. And I was like, oh, well, some might say that it's Slumdog. I mean, it won eight Oscars.
Oscar film, yeah, you're probably right.
I don't know. Maybe we can just have a quick 1 minute chat on favorite Danny Boyle film quickly. Go.
Oh, the answer is Trainspotting. But personally, for me, it's either Trainspotting or Shallow Grave, which is one of his first films and just means the world to me, that film. I love it so much.
Obviously, Trainspotting is brilliant. Slumdog is amazing. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite experiences watching one of his films, though, was 127 Hours. Watched it in the cinema with a big group of my friends. And Oh my God.
Yeah.
Like, it's suspenseful and horrifying. And the moment where he cuts his arm off is absolutely gross, but it's also kind of brilliant.
He's a really good genre filmmaker. Like, he's made some kind of meh films, like Trance isn't that good. I really like it. I really, really like it, but it's not that good. I just like him doing bits, doing whatever he wants to do. I fully trust him to make entertaining movies.
He was meant to do, linking back to the opening question, he was meant to do Bond. He was meant to do this Bond, No Time to Die. But creative differences. What's the point in doing a franchise if you're not going to get a director to do his own thing? Because that is clearly what happened. He jumped on board and said, I want to do this, 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 and this, and this my way. And they said, no, fuck off.
He wants to put a toilet scene in it, probably. Someone has to put his hand in a toilet to get a microchip or some nonsense. Yeah. But honestly, man. Yeah, it's mad.
You know, if films like Marvel can start, you know, being experimental in their director choices, and why can't fucking James Bond? You know, it's been around for 52, 53 years. Just mix it up a little bit. Mix it up. Anyway, let's give our popcorns for Slumdog Millionaire, because that's what we've been talking about for the last hour.
Please do.
This is my revisit. So as my revisit, and this is a classic thing of the more you talk about it, the more you realize you love it even more than you thought you did. So I'm going to go for a solid 90 popcorns. It is probably is Danny Boyle's best film. I probably prefer Trainspotting just for what it kind of, you know, what it represents, but this film is absolutely sublime. So 90 popcorns for me.
I think I'm going to give it 85. I gave it 80 on my notes last night, but I thought, we've talked about it too much. I love it too much. I'm probably going to watch it again this week because I now own it because I had to buy it. It's not on streaming services. So
did you not rent it?
No, I ended up buying it. It was really cheap on Apple TV. So I just thought, here's £3. You can have that. Anyway, yeah, I give it 85. It's awesome. And if for some reason and you're listening to this and we spoiled the whole thing for you and you've not watched it, give it a watch, man. It's so good. It's so, so good. And it's so, what's the word? It's so, you know, you can watch it whenever you want. You can watch it with it, whatever mood you're in. It's a boss film.
It is absolutely 100% an amazing, amazing, amazing film. Next week, we are covering 12 Angry Men. Can you believe it? One of the most critically acclaimed films of all time. I don't know anything about it other than it has 12 Angry Men in it. And I know it's shot in a, in like one location or two locations. It's and it came out in like the 1950s. But I'm super excited for my first take. I know Luke doesn't even know anything about the film. And hopefully he is fine next week. So he'll be back.
Fingers crossed. Everyone send him some nice words if you'd like.
And Connor, you are going to host because you've seen this film before, and I imagine, you big film nerd, that you love it.
I've probably watched it about 20 times, and I think it's just perfect. I love it so much. I can't wait. I really can't wait.
Yeah, I mean, there is a reason why this film is always mentioned, you know, when it comes to kind of, you know, the greatest films of all time. So let's see if I agree. You know, because my opinion matters the most. All I would like to say is please, 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 please follow us on Instagram and Twitter at First Take Pod. Ask us some questions. You know, our DMs are open. We would love to hear from you guys. If it's film suggestions or any general questions that you'd like us to ask at the start of the podcast, please go ahead and do so. We'd be eternally grateful. Next week, 12 Angry Men. This week was Slumdog. We had an absolute blast. So it's bye from me for now and bye from Connor. I'll speak for him. Ta-ra.